Greet you in Jesus' name. It's good to see visitors, all the people here, young people. It's good to see all the people between about 17 and 25. I've been thinking about you. Not long ago, I was 18 years old. And all the question marks of life stretched out on the road ahead without obvious answers. I wondered what I would work, if I would marry or whom, where I would live, whether I should go to a mission field for a while or something, somewhere overseas. I didn't really wonder if I would survive. I think I was sort of like Whittier's barefoot boy. I had health that mocks the doctor's rules. I was all like these young men, muscled up from farming and construction, and felt fit and had that energy of youth that I could hop out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning in the winter and go build things with blue fingers. And it just didn't bother me. You know, that was the joy of youth. And things like headgear and sleep was optional in those faraway days. I wasn't very anxious in my family about what could go wrong. I think that at 18, I had been largely sheltered from suffering and trauma, human frailty in my immediate social world was a blessing. Families around me, by my youthful estimation, all seemed to have fairly good marriages and intact homes and enough to eat and faithful children, and I know they didn't, but I had grown up on a farm with 4 brothers and 3 sisters, never had an injury that required medical care by age 18. Death had never intruded close to my family or friends. All my grandparents, all my uncles and aunts were still alive and well. And I realized that I think about being 18, that my blanket of security was significantly provided by the innocence of childhood. You know, you just don't know what all is going on around you when you're 18. You really don't if you're 18. And that's the way God designed it. Because if you did, you wouldn't be healthy. I'm telling you that, young people, very seriously, that God designs it that way to protect you. But it was also true that at 18, I was protected from tragedy because tragedy really hadn't happened to me by God's appointment. And looking back, I wish that an older person had sat down with me and read a story and explained a story with me in the Bible that I would like to do this morning for you if you're within 5 years of 18, one way or the other, but mostly the other. So turn to Matthew 25. The title of the message is Faithful Over a Few Things. Faithful Over a Few Things. Matthew 25, let's begin to read at verse 14. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made them other 5 talents. Likewise, he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliveredst unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant, thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliveredst unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed, and I was afraid. And I went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed? Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left. I'm just going to pause right there in the story. I would like to create the case that this is all one story. And that the gathering of the servants when the Lord came back and said, Well, how have you done? Is all of a piece with verse 34, where the judge sits down in the throne of his glory and says to everybody, Well, how have you done? It's all one story, I think. But we'll come back to that shortly. I'd like to simply take this story as much at face value as we can for you young people and see what there is to learn here. So the first point is that God has given you, like these servants, the gifts of life unearned. So these were not this man's children, were they? Were these his children? No, they were his servants, employees, maybe bondmen, we don't know. But they were not his heirs. It was not profit sharing. It was a gift. It was a complete and undeserved gift. And God has distributed to every one of us out of his love on some scale that we can't comprehend the many gifts of life. And he is that kind of benevolent giver. It could be just the sunrise, growth, food cycles, human love, physical healing, our memory, laughter, birth, our health, our creativeness, many things. And this unearned, undeserved providence is just there. And when we forget that, that's the first step toward burying it, when we forget it. So if we try to forget that, or we try to buy them, or forget that it's a gift, we're on the way to being the servant that was in trouble at the end. The second point is that here we see a master distributing his gifts, the talents here, according to the master's knowledge of each servant. He had better knowledge than the servants did, of course, but according to his knowledge of the ability. Now, presumably, this group of servants, now it's only lists 3 because it's a parable, but there was a spread there, just like there is a spread here among you young people. If God would line you up today and distribute the talents, there would be a different count for you, a different count. And he would do so. He does do so. It's not even a hypothetical. He has done so. He has distributed differently. And God's scale of value doesn't follow a human assessment of accomplishment. So he doesn't see more or less valuable youth among you young men or young sisters or people in this room or the people in Morgan County or the nations of the world. The people of Jefferson City and Haiti are equally precious in his sight. A nonverbal quadriplegic is as beautiful to God as some super gifted Olympian star. He doesn't gauge his love by your IQ. Think of it like this. If God loves infinitely, which he does, you can't measure infinite, can you? If you've ever thought about that in a mathematical sense, you can't measure something which is infinite. So if God loves every soul infinitely, there can be no degrees of value to the soul. Now, Thomas Jefferson, of course, in the Declaration of Independence, he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Self-evident that all men are created equal, and they're endowed by their Creator by certain inalienable rights, and that among these are the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, Jefferson didn't get that idea from the Bible, of course, because it wasn't even true. He got it from John Locke and the other thinkers of his time. But we'll go with the first part. Was he right in the first part that it is self-evident that all people are created equal? And if so, what was with the Lord here handing out different piles? 5 talents, 2 talents, 1 talent. Where was the equality there? Well, it is true, all souls equal in God's sight, because God doesn't measure as we measure. And one of the proofs of this is that he said, "I have given my only begotten Son, that whosoever believes may have eternal life." Now, you can't win better than eternal life, can you? Can you win anything bigger than that? So that means there's equality there. Infinite reward for every person. Now, God, as the Creator here, as the Master, assesses our diverse capacities. I want you to look at this word ability a little bit here. You catch that? He divided to every man according to his several ability. Okay, you know what that word ability is? The Greek word there is dunamis, or simply power. Here are some other verses in the New Testament that use this same Greek word. "Thine is the kingdom, the glory, and the power." Okay? "You shall receive power after the Holy Ghost has come upon you." Or some places it's interpreted, it's just translated in English as mighty works, wonderful works, miracles. Or wait, Jesus healed, that when the woman sneaked up behind Jesus that was sick, and she touched the hem of his garment, and Jesus said, "What happened?" "Somebody touched me because I felt some virtue," was the English word, but it's actually the Greek word there, dunamis, or power, or ability. "I felt some ability go out of me, some power." God hasn't given us the spirit of fear in Paul's writing, but of power and a sound mind and love. That's all this same word, dunamis. Okay, young people, how much of that quality do you think you have on your plate? How much did God put in your basket? You have a set of gifts that is this power for you to do things. And now it's easy to spot the outliers here. If there's a spread of power and ability, which there is in this story, it's easy to say, well, here's a spread from 1 talent to 5 talents somehow. And it's easy to identify the people at the edges. It's easier. Okay, so and we can do this. We sometimes would say, well, we can think of people that seem to lack much capability. I mean, just imagine a person who is severely physically handicapped or mentally, not a sound mind, or a debilitating genetic disease, blind, nonverbal, immobile, things like that. You would look at such a person, you would naturally think, oh, they can't do much. That's unfortunate. There's always a Mephibosheth somewhere near you in life, isn't there? One who can't help himself altogether. One who needs to be carried. This is how life is, and we understand that. You may even feel like Mephibosheth sometimes, depending how God has called you. You may. And on the other extreme, it's not so hard sometimes to identify the people who seem to just have a little bit too much blessing, all right? They seem to be running on a surplus of talents. They seem to be getting 5 or 10 or 20, and we look on, and we don't like it sometimes. They seem to be too confident, too sociable, too capable, too gifted, too whatever else, maybe rich, whatever, attractive. They have all the right stuff stacked up in a way that makes us admire or envy or resent them based on our own spiritual and emotional health, I suppose. But you have the extremes here, and extremes one and the other, and we can tell those. But the truth is that we ourselves and our acquaintances in the youth group here, and your young men and women, they mostly fall across a distribution in the middle there, not extremes. And you might even say, well, is it even appropriate to wonder about this? Should we wonder about it? Should we wonder if we got 2 or 5 talents? Well, I think to some extent, if your mind dwells there all the time, that is certainly a sign of some need, I suppose. But the psalmist says, think about what God has given you. Forget not all his benefits. What all does he do for you? What all has he given you? He redeems you from destruction. He crowns your life with loving kindness. He satisfies your mouth with good things. Those are talents worth thinking about. So it's not inappropriate to wonder, if you're a young person, whether you have 1, 2, or 5 talents. Now, it's uncomfortable to wonder that, don't you think? Maybe you older ones that have reflected on this for a few decades can reflect on that. And so this power, this dunamis, I'd like to just take that word apart a little bit and think about what it is that you young people might have. What is this power? Let's just define it this way. Power is the ability to control something in your environment or your world or your circumstances. That's what power is. And if you want to understand that, think about someone who has none. For example, let's think about a prisoner in cuffs, in solitary confinement, without communication, without freedom, without anything to do. How much can he control his environment? He can't. He's completely helpless. And that's why they go mad if they're left there for too many years. Or think about a totally paralyzed person. I read, and it was back when I was a teenager, I think, about that journalist in France who had suffered a debilitating stroke, and he was completely paralyzed except for one eyelid. He could move one eyelid. And, well, what could you do if all you could do anymore is move one eyelid? Well, do you know what he did? He wrote a book. Friends would show him an alphabet, and they would point at the letters, and when they got to the right letter, he would blink, and they would write that letter down. And then they would go to the next one, and he would blink, and they would write that letter down. And eventually he wrote a book that way, because his mind was sound. He was just powerless. So you think about people that really don't have the power to change their world or be free to do anything or choose anything. That's what very low power looks like. Now think about yourself. And if you have paper, you can start this list and finish it later, but you make 2 lists, young people. You have sort of capital in the bank of 2 kinds. One is a list of capital that you have received that you can't do anything about. Let's think about some of them. What kinds of things in your life give you the power to do things that you can't do anything about? Well, I can easily name some. It's your health. If you're healthy, you can go around and do things. If you're not, bedfast or something. If you're intelligent, you can do things in life, because without that really limits what you can get done. If you are emotionally healthy, you can be effective in life if you have been born into an environment or a family that isn't, crippling you somehow. Like, let's say just being born in America gives you lots of freedom and power to travel, to do things, to work things, to choose your vocation, to go about and do what you want to do. Those things you could do nothing about. And now, so that's one list. You can make all the list of things that God brought into your life that gives you a certain amount of ability. Now, the other list is all of the things that you can develop in your life that also give you power to do things. How about money? If you earn money, you can do things with it. If you don't, you're limited in a lot of things. You learn skills. You develop courage, risk tolerance. You learn good habits from mommy and daddy. They teach you how to not be obnoxious. Because if you're obnoxious in your life, in life, you can be less effective, do less, if you're self-disciplined. Well, the combination of these things is what allows you to change anything in your life or do anything of worth here. Now, I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians 12. The diversity of gifts is a feature, not a flaw, in a New Testament church. There's a whole passage here. I'm just going to read a verse or two here. 1 Corinthians 12, now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I would not have you ignorant. Now, just note here, this is talking about spiritual gifts. I was talking earlier in a broader sense of other kinds of gifts too. I wouldn't have you ignorant. Verse 5 or 6, and there are diversities of operations, but it is the same God which worketh all in all. Verse 8, for to one is given by the Spirit the word of wisdom, to another the word of knowledge by the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another the gifts of healing by the same Spirit, to another the working of miracles, to another prophecy, to another discerning of spirits, to another divers kinds of tongues, to another in the interpretation of tongues, and so on. And he talks about how this all comes together. Does everybody have the gifts of healing? Do all speak with tongues? No. But covet earnestly the best gifts, he says at the end of the passage. So each of you young people already has some set of inclinations, some set of unique abilities to serve unlike anybody else. And it's enjoyable to look around a congregation and get to know people and see the variety in any brotherhood. You know, there's the quiet people and the noisy people, the timid people and the courageous people, the cautious and the bold, the tender and the tough, the reflective and the non-reflective types. There's just, all of those have strengths. And see, now's where we get into the tricky territory, because the distribution of these gifts in your life, you compared to the young man beside you or the sister beside you, the distribution of these gifts in your life is always liable to look unfair or random or unequal. You young people did not all equally succeed in school in the same way. You're not all equally attractive. You're not all equally advantaged with self-confidence or strong parents. Some of you may feel limited by a lack of money. Others of you are probably more crippled with too much money. You'll understand that when you get older, but that's not your fault. Because when you're 18 and you have plenty of money, that's a crippling handicap. It takes a few years to learn that, though. So these are spread of things that happen to us that we feel like we received and we're not sure what to do with. And we're always around young people who make us feel a little dumb, a little the wrong size or something, a little the wrong thing. And we have to deal with that. And so my next point here is that God has inscrutable and eternal purposes say that again, if you don't use that word a lot, inscrutable means hard to understand. God has inscrutable and eternal purposes for what appears to be unequal distribution. You remember the story in John 8 where Jesus and the disciples came to a man who was born blind, and they got to discussing this. Why can't this man see? Why is he born blind? And they said, who sinned, this man or his parents? And Jesus said, nobody sinned here, but that the works of God should be made manifest through him. Oh, so what if you're the blind person in your social group? I mean, blind metaphorically, maybe literally, but how would God get glory from that? Well, what else can we say? If you see a person around you or in our group here who seems to be crippled by handicaps of some kind, how is God speaking through his eternal purposes through this person to our congregation for our good? It's a kind of ministry. And when Lazarus was sick and Martha and Mary, they called for Jesus. He didn't get there in time and Lazarus died. And Lazarus finally gets there and he said to the sisters and the people there, he said, this sickness was not for death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. And somehow, in a way that is so hard to understand, you're going to find out that you are limited, or somebody in your social world is limited in some way that you can't understand, but it's for the glory of God, and God's eternal purposes are worked out through it. See, God's arithmetic, we heard it this morning in the sovereignty talk about the potter and the clay, but God's arithmetic isn't like man's. You remember when they were at the temple there and people, all the millionaires and the tycoons and the fat cats were walking by, putting in big checks and into the offering, and then the poor widow came along, she put her two little pennies in there, and Jesus said, see that? Now that's real giving right there. That is some amazing sharing there, because she gave more than all the rest. And so that same principle is true in the talents thing, the distribution of talents. But the truth of it is, just about anybody goes through a time in their life when they say, why hast thou made me thus? We heard that in the Sunday school. Why hast thou made me thus? Why do I have my set of parents? Really? Why do I look the way I do? Why is my job and my work going the way it is? Why hast thou made me thus? Why do I have anxiety? Why do I fear? Why? Yeah, these can be mirror thoughts. They can be checkbook thoughts. They can be committee thoughts. They can be popping up a lot of places. Why have you made me this way? And what people don't often realize is that the five talent people ask it at the same rate as the one talent people. Did you know that? The five talent people ask that question as often as the one talent people. You just look at Apostle Paul. I mean, would you say Apostle Paul was kind of lacking in talents? We don't know. We didn't meet him, but it seemed like he was pretty loaded up on to some extent. And yet there was that time where he was talking to the Corinthians and he was really facing some headwinds with Corinth. They must have been sort of critical of him somehow. And he said there, yeah, they say his letters are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech is contemptible. I mean, he's a good writer, but he's a really boring preacher. And Paul, you could just tell the sort of anxiety coming out of there. And he was writing to them, I know what you think. And you could almost hear the tone of doubt in Paul's mind. Like, yeah, they say that about me. And maybe it's true. And so anybody can ask that question. Why have you made me thus? Where do we take our talent doubts? Where do we take them? Well, we can take them to God, but it's a hard thing. And Jesus said at one point to the people listening in the Sermon on the Mount, well, what would you like to do with what you don't like about yourself? How about if you think you're too short? And what did he say to them? Can you just pop it up, add a cubit to your stature to be the height you want to be? Because height matters in our culture. You know, if you're tall, you're more likely to be noticed than if you're short. Nobody wants to be super short. And Jesus said, can you do anything about it? No, you can't do anything about it. Can't do anything about it. If God so took care of this and he clothes the grass of the, isn't he going to take care of you? No, you can't do anything about it. So our doubts about the way God made us. I will say this. It might be 18 now. Give it a few decades. And what you saw as inequality across your youth group or your friends, what you saw as unequal, give it a few decades and watch how life unfolds for people, and you begin to see it's not so different, is it? Any of you older ones can agree with that? It's not so different. After some life experience, you see that the people that you envied when you were young, you're not so sure if you would have wanted their path after all. Because it just evens out a little bit more as life goes on. And Paul, the Corinthians were quarreling over following popular people. I'm of Apollos. I'm of Cephas. I'm of Paul. Well, I like the way this one preaches, and I like the way that one does things and so forth. And Paul said, oh, stop it. That's so immature. Who maketh thee to differ from another? He said, what hast thou that thou diddst not receive? And if you received it, why glory as if thou hadst not received it? So I remember years ago reading an essay, Every Man's Desire to Be Somebody Else. It stuck with me, where the essayist was saying in there that you know, it's just true in life that we have a job or we have a station, we have the thing we do in life, and then But while we're doing it, we kind of wish we'd be doing something else. We wish we'd be somebody else. And so, you know, the man who builds houses might dream that he's going to work on cars, or he's going to be a mechanic, and the mechanic wishes he'd be a pilot, and the pilot wishes he'd be a surgeon, and the surgeon wishes he'd be a psychiatrist, and so on. We all have that sort of longing, that dream that if things had been a little different in my life, I could have done something else. Have you ever heard an older person say that? I wish I had done something different back there, and by now I could be doing this. Ever hear that? Anybody ever hear that? That's a common kind of thing. And that is sort of central here to the story. But you know what? Let's look at the end of the story here a little bit now. Because when we start talking about one talent and burying it, we get into some dangerous streets here in a hurry. What was really the sin of this servant with one talent? Something I learned in studying this that gave me a huge relief. I think I've always struggled with this story on this point. If this Lord of these servants represents God, which I think that's obvious, right? This is like God. I was always bothered by the fact that at the end of the story, when the one servant says, well, your sum, you steal. That's essentially what the charge was. You gather where you didn't sow. You're swiping from people. You are an unjust judge, that servant was saying. So I knew you were like that, so what's the use of serving? I just buried your talent. You can have it back. But the accusation was, you are an unjust master. And the King James reads as though the master says, well, so what? Everybody knows that. Isn't that how it sounds? Well, so what? You knew I'm that way. That's not an excuse. But what I actually found out is that most Bible versions, most Bible translations frame that from the Greek as a question, where it's more like this, where the servant said, well, you steal from people. You're unjust. And the master said, do you know that? Really? What proof do you have of that? Is that really true? Do you know that I'm that kind of master? Well, and even if it were true, you should have at least put it in the bank. So it's more like, do you know that I'm that kind of person? It was a challenge. The master was calling his bluff. In other words, the one talent servant was lying. That wasn't true. That wasn't true. He was an unjust master. But he was lying, and he was hiding behind his sloth and his unbelief, what made him bury the talent. He was trying to hide behind an accusation that the master was predatory and unfair. And the thing we have to tie together there is, where do you think that one talent servant got the notion that his master was unjust? Where do you think? You think it was because he looked at his talent, and he looked at his talent, and then he looked at the other one with five, and he looked at his one, and he looked at the five, and he looked at the two, and he said, what's this all about? I'm on the bottom of the pile here. Forget it. If that's how you are, I'll just bury the talent. I don't feel like trying. So the sin, and the master says, you wicked and lazy servant. Now, if you ever get called into your job and you get a quarterly employment review, you know, you get called in with the boss and it's time to do an employment performance review. And he starts out by saying, well, we need to talk about something. You are a wicked and slothful employee. You know you're about to get fired. Like, that's pretty bad right there. This isn't sort of just like you haven't done very well. You have utterly failed, and you are an immoral person besides. Why was this so terrible? Because the sin was unbelief, and the sin was to be ungrateful that he got this one talent, and he said, well, is that all I get? Because look around, is that all I get? Well, forget it then. Well, he did nothing with it. And so the question, we don't want to go down that street, that would be bad. The question for you young people then is, how should I trade? How should you trade? I don't know if you have 1, 2, 5, or 100 talents what God gave you. I'm sure it's different here, among up and down the benches here. But what should you trade? What should you do? And here's where I want to finish the story. Go to the rest of the chapter now, which I'm saying is the same story. Verse 34, then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was and hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. And then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee hungry? And so on, and so on. And the answer here is, what shall you, youth, do with the talents you have? This stuff. Help people who need help. That's your commission in life. That's how you go from one talent to two, from 2 to 4, from 5 to 10. That's how it multiplies. That's how you become fruitful in the kingdom. See, it's like this, young people. You have entered the world like every other young person, and you have two tasks. I mean, yes, you need to serve the Lord, but I'm saying materially you have two tasks. One is you need to pay for your own rice and roof. That is, you need to eat something and you need shelter and you need to pay for that. You need to work for it. Either you do or someone does it for you. It's that simple. Either I buy my rice or someone buys me my rice. And the second task is that you should earn enough to buy some rice and pay for a roof for someone who can't. That's your commission in life, because not everybody can. Now, if you say, well, wait a minute, that sounds like I'm earning my way in life. Oh, no, but it's still your job. If you don't buy your rice, somebody else has to. So your first task, young men, is to grow up into a young man who can buy his own rice, if possible. And then have enough of money to buy rice for somebody who can't. And I'm not talking about a wife. If you're a young lady and you think, well, I don't know if I'll buy my own food in life. I hope I have a husband who buys it for me. Don't worry about that. That's just a partnership. The husband and wife is just a partnership, and they've decided to pool their resources and specialize their tasks so that the one raises children and the other gets the paycheck. But together they are buying their rice, and they're buying their rice for their children who can't buy their rice yet. That's how it works, okay? So you have a commission in life to pay for your own rice and roof, because there will be many people in life that can't, through disability, through disaster, through misfortune, through sin, all kinds of things. Someone else will have to help. And that's why the talent gathering is not about money, folks. It's not about money. I know this sounds like money in this story, but what did these servants come back and say? Look what we have done. I think it was verse 34, 35, and 36, where the master said, "Oh, you have been feeding people that can't buy rice. You have been visiting the sick." Well, did you catch the word joy in here anywhere? Where was it? Verse 21, he told the man with 5 and 2 talents, "Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord." Bringing in our talents for reckoning is a time of shared joy between master and servant. Do you catch that? Like, who is delighted? Who was delighted here? The master was. You know, the servant came up and said, "I got 5 more talents. Wonderful. Enter into my joy, the joy of thy Lord. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy." You know, there's we sing, "We shall come rejoicing" in the song. Well, that's a Bible verse. "He that goes planting, bearing precious seed, he shall doubtless come at last, bearing his sheaves with him and rejoicing." And so whether you're conscious of that or not, you know, in Matthew 25's story here, the people who visited the sick in prison and fed the hungry, the master said, "Well, thank you for that." And they said, "Well, we didn't know we did that." So there's a sense in which the sheaf, bringing in the sheaves, is not always countable in that way. "But unto whom 5 talents are given, of him shall much be required. And unto whom 1 or half a talent is given, unto him is less required," or her. I would like to conclude by saying that blessed is that servant who, when his Lord comes, shall find him so doing. We're here as a congregation talking about outreach someday, efforts to reach others in the community, evangelistic things, building a church, whatever. And I see rows of young men with earning power and young sisters with skills and gifts. And I can see in your eyes, young people, that no matter what your particular set of skills and gifts are, that you probably spend some time wondering, what can I do? What can I do? The reason I wanted to share this story with you this morning is at the end of the chapter here, you've been given these resources to help people, not yourself. Because we live in a world that is telling you through the internet and social media that your highest sense of fulfillment is to gratify yourself and have stuff and get attention. And that is a self-centered kind of view that is exactly the equivalent of burying your talent, because you're not going to have anything to show when the Lord comes back. The whole world tells you that fulfillment is sought out in spending money and dressing up your vehicle and your clothes and trying different things to be noticed and trying to get attention because, well, maybe I'm a little short on talents, and so I'll show off a little bit or something. I want attention. And all of that is talent burying, and all you need to do is go look for people who are hungry or need friends or need visiting and minister to those people, and you will have joy at the end of your life, no matter what comes. We're going to pray, and afterward, I would like the song leader to lead us in 906 in Hymns of the Church. Let's kneel.